Case number 12-5217, Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, Appellant versus United States of America et al. Mr. Stromer for the appellant, Mr. Kenner for the appellees.
May it please the court. This is the latest chapter of a long-running series of cases that have been litigated over the past 20 years over the United States' liability for administrative costs to Indian tribes who have contracts with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. For over 20 years, the Indian Health Service, as well as the Bureau of Indian Affairs, have taken the position that they are not liable for paying full contract support costs or administrative costs associated with these contracts with tribes around the country. Over the past 10 years, courts around the country, Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, administrative law firms, courts of appeals, as well as the United States Supreme Court have addressed this liability question. And it is now absolutely clear that the United States failed to pay contract support costs as required by the statute, and it is liable. We are still dealing with some other defenses that the United States raised with respect to these claims, procedural defenses, primarily in this case. So with liability clear, what we have before the court is the question of whether or not the Menominee Tribe of Indians filed its claims for some of the years in which it had claims timely under the statute of limitations. We've been here before. The last time that we visited this court, the question was whether or not class action tolling or equitable tolling in the alternative applied to the statute of limitations under the Contract Disputes Act. This court, just like the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled that class action tolling did not apply. Both remanded the cases back to the lower courts for a determination of whether or not equitable tolling applied on the facts. In January of 2012, the district court in this case issued a decision finding that equitable tolling did not apply. We believe that she misapplied the equitable tolling test and misapplied the facts in this case and ruled incorrectly. And we're here asking you to reverse that ruling. On November 9th of 2012, the other case, the sister case that has been tied at the hip of the Menominee Tribes case, the Arctic Slope Native Association case in the Court of Appeals in the Federal Circuit, issued a decision. That decision also challenged an initial decision by the Civilian Board of Appeals.
Excuse me, could I just get you to focus in on the equitable tolling issue here? You agree, I take it, that you have to satisfy both elements of the Holland test, right?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what's your best case about the existing extraordinary circumstance that prevented timely filing?
What's the extraordinary circumstances in this case? First, the backdrop against which we need to look at these cases, in our view, is the time frame within which decisions were made by the tribe. And at the time, they were, just like the Arctic Slope Native Association, members of a pending class action that had been certified without either one of them having to present their claims. They relied on the belief that because the Raymer class was certified without them having to present, that the subsequent class efforts to certify classes against the Indian Health Service, Cherokee in our case and Zuni in the case of the Arctic Slope Native Association, would similarly be certified as class actions. In fact, they were not. We know that now, in hindsight. But at the time, it was very reasonable for the Menominee Tribe to rely on the fact that they were part of this other class action that basically fit the exact same profile as the Cherokee case.
The two prongs of the test rely on the same circumstances, right? In other words, the facts that support your argument that they were diligent are the same facts that support the extraordinary circumstance?
In part, Your Honor. The extraordinary circumstances encompass both the complex jurisdictional litigation that was going on at the class action level as well as throughout the country about the question of liability at the time these decisions were made. But they also incorporate two equitable factors that Judge Collier did not really address at all in her decision, which were raised in the briefing, but were completely omitted. In contrast, the Federal Circuit focused on them and thought that they were important, and we believe they're important as well. There is, in the Indian Self-Determination Act and the contracts that are at issue here, very clear language that spells out the unique trust responsibility between the United States and tribes. We think that's an important factor that should be part of the overall analysis of whether or not equitable tolling applies.
Why is that an important factor, the trust relationship? The government has argued that it was clear after the Cherokee class was not certified and that you weren't able to rely on that, that you should have filed an administrative claim. Why does the trust relationship bear on that?
The trust relationship is an important part of the backdrop of the claims that are at issue here, because the Indian Self-Determination Act is a statute that was specifically enacted by Congress to set in place a process that would reflect the unique relationship between the United States and tribes. And throughout the statute, as well as the contracts themselves, there are specific references to the United States' responsibility to read the statute in the way that is most favorable to Indians as the statute is being implemented, as well as similar provisions in the contract. So we think that that responsibility, specifically as articulated in the context of the Indian Self-Determination Act, is an important part of the backdrop against which these claims should be evaluated.
You said in your reply brief, you just mentioned two points. One was the lack of prejudice, and one was the relationship. In your reply brief, you say the tribe does not argue the lack of prejudice provides an independent basis for equitable tolling, but merely that IHS had adequate notice and that the tribe relies on documentary evidence so that IHS cannot claim prejudice to avoid tolling. That sounds like, at least with respect to that one, you agree, first you have to establish tolling, then the government would be able to show prejudice if they could, but in this case they can't. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so therefore, the lack of prejudice has nothing to do with your ability to establish tolling. It's only a response to the government's response, correct?
Well, I would characterize it slightly differently, Your Honor. I think it's part of the extraordinary circumstances.
Well, that's not what you said.
The second prong of the
test. That's not what you said in the reply brief. You said you're relying on it so that IHS cannot claim prejudice to avoid tolling. So do you have a different position than now?
Well, the government's claiming that prejudice is one of the factors as part of the circumstances that should be evaluated,
right.
Should lead the court to conclude that tolling is not
appropriate.
The government's
arguing that if you establish the first two elements, the elements of Holland, then it gets to show prejudice, right, which would counter those, but then you can counter that by showing no prejudice. Do I not have the analysis right there?
I think in part, but I think it's part of the extraordinary set of circumstances as well, Your Honor.
Well, the wording in Holland is some extraordinary circumstances stood in his way and prevented timely filing. Now, the fact that the government was or wasn't prejudiced is no part of anything standing in your way, was it?
No, I think that's a fair statement.
So that, can't be. So what is it that stood in your way? That's a pretty strong phrase in Holland. In your brief, you say you don't have to show stood in your way, but Holland clearly says you do.
So. Well, the litigation history at that point in time made it absolutely clear that it would have been a futile exercise for the tribe to file a claim. The United States took the position, and most courts up until that time, at that particular juncture in time, agreed with the United States that the United States was not liable for these contract support costs.
On that theory, a party could wait on an unestablished argument about liability until some other party had succeeded. That can't be right. The whole point of suing is to establish liability. You have a difference in opinion from the government. In your view, you were the better in that argument. The way you establish that is by filing and pursuing your litigation, not by waiting until somebody else determines whether or not you have liability. The Supreme Court had never ruled that there was no liability here. So I don't understand how that stood in your way.
Well, there are cases, and we've cited them in our brief, that stand for the proposition that an unsettled legal landscape is one of the factors that can be used to justify not aggressively going after one's.
That has to do with diligence. That doesn't.
Correct.
That doesn't have to do with stand in your way. Was there a decision in your circuit that said there was no liability at the time?
I do not believe so.
Right. So maybe you could argue that if your circuit and district had held that, well, then you had some reason not to file. But I don't see how, in this circumstance, you get over this, stood in your way. The argument about Ramah seems a little bit somewhat weaker, right? Because Ramah, or is it Ramah? How do you pronounce it?
I say it Ramah, okay, but others say Ramah. So.
You say potato, I say potato.
Exactly.
Yeah. That case was filed at a time when there was no statute of limitations with respect to filing administrative claims, right?
That's correct.
And so,
but there was a presentment requirement.
But not within any particular time. Right?
That's correct. But right. There was a presentment requirement. And here we're talking about the presentment requirement, which was the basis in Zuni for the court not to certify the class. Mm-hmm. We didn't know until Zuni, and this case was filed before Zuni, and the last series of cases, the Asna case and the decision that was issued by this court, that presentment would in fact be a bar to class action tolling.
I thought that was established earlier in Cherokee.
It was not, Your Honor. The class was not certified, but based on numerosity, not based on presentment. In fact, in that decision, the judge was very careful and explicit about the fact that he was not issuing a decision on presentment.
Why did it take so long after? So Cherokee was decided against you on the class, and there was no appeal. Why didn't you file immediately then? What was the point of waiting?
Well, for two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, Menominee believed that it was entitled to equitable to tolling based on the amount of time that the certification in the Cherokee case was pending.
How is that diligent? Even if you believe that, wouldn't the diligent thing to do at this point is to file individual since the class had been disallowed?
Well, the question, as I understand it, as the courts have framed the test, is was it reasonable for the tribe and was it reasonably diligent in pursuing the rights? And the answer from our perspective is it was. The legal landscape that we just discussed in terms of the questionable nature of liability at the time was still very much alive. In fact, there were a lot more decisions at the time that found that the United States was not liable than there was that found the United States liable.
Putting aside the questionable liability ground, if we're unpersuaded by that, and if we're just dealing with the potential tolling impact of the various class actions, Ramah, Cherokee, Zuni, can you give us your clearest account of how the Menominee were calculating the time that they had? In other words, they had 6 years, but they took longer than 6 years.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which are the tolling circumstances on which you're relying that allow you nonetheless to file a claim as if it's timely?
Menominee is relying entirely on the time period that the Cherokee certification process was pending.
Okay, so then the question is, if we agree with you, there are two possible ways to treat that circumstance. If we were to agree with you that the Cherokee, the pendency of the Cherokee class, putative class, told the limitations period, then the question becomes, do you then just tack on the remainder of the 6 years following the denial of certification in Cherokee? Or because we're in the land of equitable tolling here, are you required to have diligence and use only the time you need to get your claim filed in court?
Our position, obviously, is that the entire amount of time that the class certification process was pending gets added on to the 6-year statute of limitations. At the time, Cherokee believed that class action tolling would apply, not equitable tolling, and that's the rule under class action tolling. Now, we know today that that's not the case, that the law is different, but at the time, that's what Cherokee believed. And it was not an unreasonable belief based on the state of law at the time, particularly in their membership in the Rama class, which still is a certified class today. So I think everything has to be looked at within the framework of the time frame that the Menominee tribe was making the decisions on that particular question, and really on all of the questions.
You say in your brief at one point that one of the factors that we should take account of is the tribe's limited resources, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So does that relate to the resources it would be required to file a claim?
To file and then litigate the claim.
Well, just file. Let's start.
Well, it's a combination of both. The filing is fairly simple.
What I was guessing. You don't have any quarrel with the district court's finding that it's, quote, relatively simple.
No quarrel with that, Your Honor. Okay, so, it's a relatively easy process. That's correct.
And so then where do the resources come in?
Litigating the claim. Uh-huh. I mean, once you file the claim, you're triggering litigation. Uh-huh. And as the pattern and history of these cases demonstrates over the past 20 years, the United States has fought full frontal warfare on tribes over these contract support cost claims. And at the time, in particular, there was no reason to believe that the United States wouldn't do exactly that with Menominee. Mm-hmm. So they had to make choices about their resources. I mean, the filing of the claim itself, in my mind, when you talk about the costs that were associated, that would be associated with the litigation, is really a small part of the picture. It's what we're doing here, the Second Court of Appeals argument, that's really the true picture of the cost for the tribe.
Where would it have been litigated after the claim was filed? This was filed administratively, right?
The claim was filed administratively.
It would have been, yeah. Then
what? Well, it could have been litigated in the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals or in federal court, and Menominee chose to litigate the claim here.
And is it any part of your argument that there, once you filed the claim, the one-year clock begins to run, and so there's a kind of approach avoidance about filing that claim, or am I inferring too much? I mean, was it a factor in delaying filing that once you file, then you're going to quickly, once you file administratively, then you're going to quickly have to go into court? Under this scheme?
I don't think quickly was necessarily in mind, but the way that all of the other cases had proceeded in that particular time was that the United States was going to deny the claim. They denied all the other claims that were filed up until then. So at that point, if that happened 2 months later, if it happened 6 months later, the tribe would be looking at litigation options. So either the 90-day option to go to the board or to go to federal court within a year. But it would be looking at litigation. And so obviously part of the calculus was to avoid the cost of litigation. I mean, the tribe wanted to be part of the class. That was much more efficient for everybody if a class had been certified, because all these cases would have been folded under one big tent, just like the REMA class was certified and deals with all the BIA claims. On the IHS side, that's why there are dozens of claims pending around the country. No class was certified.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the government.
May it please the court. The question here is not about Indian law. It's not even about the Contract Disputes Act. This question revolves around entirely how the equitable principle of equitable tolling will be administered in this circuit. The tribe is arguing that this court, as it did below, should ignore the precedent of the Supreme Court in Holland and permit its chosen course of non-action to replace the diligent pursuit of the claim that is required in the Holland decision, much less the identification of an extraordinary circumstance that would have stood in the tribe's way. Rather than pursue the course that the tribe suggests here, which conflicts with this circuit's precedent, as well as that recognized by the by many other circuits, the 5th, the 10th, the 9th, certainly the 2nd, as we note on in our brief, this court should maintain in this circuit, as it has before, announced certainly in Smith-Haney, that equitable tolling is only available in rare and extraordinary circumstances in accordance with the Holland guidance by the Supreme Court.
Mr. Kenner, the government doesn't really dispute that if we were to find that the Holland factors were met by the pendency of the class certification petition in the Cherokee case, that the result would be that that period of time that elapsed during before the court ruled on that motion would be tacked on to the 6 years. You don't really dispute that.
Well, actually, I'm not sure I followed my hearing is bad. But the government's position would clearly be, first, that class tolling simply doesn't apply here in any way.
I understand that.
Right. And so there is no extension of the time for Menominee in this case. More importantly, if Menominee was waiting, as the only evidence before the trial court shows, Menominee was waiting, and as counsel just described, that they were waiting for whatever resolution was in Cherokee. Well, while they waited, in fact, by the time the Supreme Court granted cert in Cherokee, the statute of limitations on their claims had run. So they had waited through their statute of limitations, deciding that apparently, based upon the concerns for litigation, the burdens of litigation, not to pursue their claims.
So if we were to find that equitable tolling applied during the period, just not of the Supreme Court litigation determining the merits, but just in the trial court, when the Menominee believed that they might be within that Cherokee class before certification was denied, if that period alone somehow met the requirements of equitable tolling, then I understand the government not to dispute that that period would be added onto the 6 years,
yes.
And that's how it would be calculated.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. But indeed, that heightens the tension of Menominee's argument here, because indeed, once the Cherokee class decision was made, there was time remaining, time for Menominee to meet with its extended, in that scenario, an extended period of time, an extended statute of limitation, and they still waited. And indeed, this is what the trial court was faced with. The only evidence before the trial court was
But if you're accepting the theory that tolling means that we tack on to the end the suspended time period, then they did file in enough time after the Cherokee decision. Because that would have extended their time all the way up until the Cherokee decision to continue to file.
I'm sorry, are you referring to the Cherokee, the Supreme Court Cherokee?
No. I'm referring to the denial of...
The denial of the cert.
Yeah.
Right.
No, the...
I mean, too many C words, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Right, the denial
yes.
of the class by yes. the district court. Yes. Yes, there was time available for the...
I understand there's an intra-circuit split about this. We have two different kinds of cases. It's not clear they're completely different, but one argument would be that as long as they had sufficient time after the denial of class certification in Cherokee, and here they had many months still to go, even without tacking, that they weren't showing due diligence. But another argument is that if they were entitled to the full amount of time up until the class certification denial, then they could rest as long as they wanted to until the end of the tacking. The government's position, though, is that tacking is the appropriate way to interpret, to apply equitable tolling? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, I think we would assert that consistently that no, the answer would be no, that would not be the correct calculation after the extension that Menominee is seeking, would be seeking in that scenario would not be a replacement of the 6-year statute of limitation. it would still have to calculate the time during the pendency before the trial court.
And I understand you're disputing very much that they were diligent and that there were extraordinary circumstances that would allow them to rely as a matter of equitable tolling on the pendency of the class certification motion in Cherokee. Can you address the Menominee's argument about extraordinary circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. Very, very succinctly, effectively in this case, there's no place for the special circumstances argument. Although there is certainly a point in the self-determination statute where Congress directed the government to be aware of and apply the consideration of special relationship with the tribes. That admonition by Congress for the Self-Determination Act does not then mean that these statute of limitations in the Contract Disputes Act, which is referenced or relied upon in the Self-Determination Act, is then done away with. That because, in fact, the Supreme Court has said that the United States' relationship with the tribes is not based upon this amorphous trust relationship, but rather it is defined by statute.
Right. But once the Supreme Court has ruled that the government does, in fact, owe to all the tribes contract support costs, is it consistent with the government's fiduciary duty toward the tribes to continue to withhold? I mean, that decision was rendered when the Menominee's claims remained timely. Why then is the government within its rights to defend on statute of limitations grounds when it was clear to the government that it had a fiduciary duty to this entity and that they were obligated legally to pay?
Indeed, Your Honor, that is really in many ways the absolute crux of this. Why equitable tolling counts whether or not it applies here is because indeed all those questions remain open. I'm sorry, when I say all those questions, what I mean is that the assertion that, well, it's been determined, the Supreme Court said in Rama, you have to pay full contract support costs. Well, in fact, there's nobody in the country, no tribe and no agency in the federal government knows what full contract support costs means. And in fact, those issues, the statute of limitations and proof of quantum and things that are typically encountered in contract relations are all present in every one of these claims every year. And so,
maybe I'm not following exactly. Imagine the Supreme Court had held, in circumstances identical to yours, that more money was owed. And the only remaining issue is whether the equitable tolling period had passed, whether there was equitable tolling. I think Judge Pillard is asking you, in light of the relationship between the tribes and the United States, would it be appropriate under those circumstances to apply to cut off the tribe's ability to receive the funds? What's the answer to that?
Well, indeed, Your Honor, I think the answer would be yes.
Yes, it would be okay to cut off.
Yes. If indeed the definitive nature of the decisions were as you were describing, then it would be probably appropriate for the United States to recognize, well, due to the special relationship, the agencies do not need to parse any further the amounts necessary. However,
then in those circumstances, you're saying that they would be entitled to equitable tolling. Is that what you're saying?
Indeed. Well, and actually, Your Honor,
the statute of limitations doesn't apply where the tribe has a clear right to the money. Is that the government's position?
No, certainly not.
It sounded like that's what you're saying.
No, what I was trying to respond to was the notion that the blend of the idea of the special relationship and succeeding court determinations that an agency is responsible to a tribe for X amount of money, and indeed increased support contract support costs in a given year for under a specific contract, to the extent that that's defined certainly the special relationship would govern or instruct the United States, the executive agencies, to respond accordingly, as in stand down and, okay, we won't fight anymore. But what the distinction I'm trying to draw, and I may be screwing up these questions, I'm sorry, or confusing them, but the distinction I'm trying to draw is that we're not at that point where
you've completely confused me now. I had read your brief as saying the special relationship doesn't apply in a contract situation. Did I misread that?
Well, no, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
Well, then if that's true, if that's the government's position, isn't the answer to both Judge Bullard and Chief Judge Garland's answers that it doesn't really make any difference how final or complete the merits are? And I'm not saying I agree with this, but I assume the government's, or at least I thought I understood the government's position to be that the special relationship is irrelevant. This is a contract.
Indeed. However, Your Honor, that's why I'm drawing this distinction between if, and I may be extrapolating too far the hypothetical.
Did I read your brief correctly?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did I read your brief correctly?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly. Yeah. We would urge the court to uphold the district court's finding, because as the district court was concluding, there was nothing presented to the district court upon which it could find that the tribe had met either prong of the Holland test.
Well, what's your answer to the Menominee's argument that in the Irwin case, Supreme Court's opinion states, we've allowed equitable tolling in situations where the claimant has actively pursued his judicial remedies by filing a defective pleading during the statutory period, and the example being given, American Pipe, where the plaintiff's timely filing of a defective class action tolled the limitations period as to the individual claims of purported class members?
I think the district court correctly observed that argument does not apply or cannot be constructed here, because, in fact, notwithstanding the note in Irwin, the application of American Pipe was to class action tolling. This court has previously identified that class action tolling does not apply here, and more appropriately, that the extension of their arguments their various extensive arguments attempting to create a link between class action tolling and equitable tolling do not find support in any of the cases, especially not in American Pipe, notwithstanding the note in Irwin. And that is the problem with a lot of the argument here on the tribe's part, is that it revolves around effectively a class action tolling premise. And the problem with all of that is that class action tolling simply has no relevance here at all, because class action tolling is really a question about your time when you get to court. And the tribe wasn't even worried about getting to court. The tribe was worried about submitting its administrative claim. And had it acted at all, if there was any action whatsoever, then we wouldn't be here. But instead, the reliance upon what should be characterized as class action tolling, which does not apply here, cannot be extended to their equitable tolling argument.
Thank you. Is there any time left? All right, we'll give you an extra 2 minutes to rebut. Thank you. Hold on 1 second. Let me get out of the way.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just make one point to follow up on the last exchange to make it absolutely clear, and I think our briefs do this already. We are not relying on class action tolling. We're relying on the facts surrounding the Menominee tribe's belief that it was entitled to class action tolling or to tolling generally under equitable tolling rules to justify equitable tolling in this case. And we think that Irwin's footnote that incorporates American Pipe cannot be read the way the government or the court, the lower court, read it, because that makes that footnote reference meaningless. If, in fact, what the Supreme Court intended to do was to cross-reference a case which by its very own terms deals only with class action tolling and intended to say nothing by that, then the government is right. But we have a difficulty believing that. And we think what the Supreme Court intended to do was to illustrate with that case that a class action certification effort that does not succeed is an example of a defective pleading. So that really concludes my comments.
Further questions from the panel?
Yeah.
Take the matter under submission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.